KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Good morning. It is 9:02, and you are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, your listener-sponsored, democratically-run radio station, Radio for the People, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. The mole is the beast that burrows underground, exposing and undermining the foundations of the system of exploitation and oppression that allows a wealthy few to control the lives and labor of the rest of us, a system known as capitalism. The mole does more than expose and subvert. It also works to support the many grassroots movements dedicated to building a world that works for all of us, one in which our laborers contribute not to the profits of the rich, but to the full and free development of all humanity and to the flourishing of all life on this earth. I'm Clayton Morgeridge, your host for today's show. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. On today's show, we'll be hearing three conversations. Bill Resnick and Dave Finkel will be looking at the powers wreaking havoc on the lands and peoples of the Middle East, namely the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel. Jan Hawken talks with Jane Hassinger, psychoanalyst and University of Michigan researcher, about her work with abortion providers. They take up the Trump administration's revival of the gag rule against U.S. aid for family planning services and how groups of providers are resisting abortion stigma. And Desiree Helligers will be talking with Northwest singer and songwriter Jim Page about his life as a politically engaged musician and busker, and we'll hear some of his music. If you want to hear this show again, or any part of it, or recommend it to your friends, you will be able to find it on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, along with additional information about our topics and guests. Well, leading off today's show, here are the Old Moles Bill Resnick and writer and activist Dave Finkel to fill us in on who and what is behind the ongoing carnage in the Middle East.
Dave Finkel, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, glad to be here.
Dave Finkel edits the journal Against the Current. He writes a good deal for Against the Current and other publications, primarily on U.S. politics and the Middle East, with a particular interest in Palestine-Israel. Dave, you wrote a recent editorial on the Middle East Today, the current wars, some very vicious, killing really vast numbers of mostly poor civilians. You also wrote on the growing momentum for larger, more destructive wars, and these pushed by a de facto coalition of Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S., all for their own purposes, all very ugly purposes. And you've also discussed climate change, its impact in creating the conditions that led to the current wars and continue to worsen. So, Dave, it's not a pretty picture. Give us a sense of Middle Eastern politics and struggles today.
Well, it's not a pretty picture. If I could make a shameless plug, the editorial that you mentioned, along with other articles from our magazine, Against the Current, is on our website. It's www.solidarity-us.org. I think that to put this in an overall framework, we have to recognize that the defeat, at least in the first wave, of the Democratic Arab uprisings from 2011, the so-called Arab Spring, is an enormous setback for progressive hopes in the region and internationally, as well as in the specific countries, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, and in fact even Libya, where these uprisings started. It's terribly tragic for the peoples involved and for all of us. Two other things that you touched on briefly. The spread of a growing war coalition tying together Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States, which has practically destroyed the country of Yemen in a proxy war with Iranian or somewhat Iranian-backed forces, bringing about famine, cholera, and diphtheria. It's absolutely horrifying, and the United States is deeply, deeply involved in it.
They're starving them to death as well. Right?
Through its military supplies and refueling of Saudi aircraft. And the third thing, which is underpublicized, is the impact of climate catastrophe, global warming, desertification, the drought in Syria for several years leading up to what began as a popular uprising against the Assad dictatorship. Many, many thousands of farmers had their livelihoods destroyed by the drought. They moved into the periphery of big cities. There was no work for them. It exacerbated the social crisis leading to that upheaval. There's also an enormous drought right now in Iran, which is threatening the water supply in a number of important Iranian cities. This is a global thing. Sometime you should have somebody from South Africa talking about the water catastrophe looming in Cape Town, but that's another whole discussion. But all of these things have combined together, along with other things like Donald Trump kicking the Palestinians in the teeth, saying they'll move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, even worse, cutting off funds to the United Nations Relief Works Agency for Palestinians. So it's a convergent and desperate set of circumstances.
Dave, let's talk about that de facto coalition between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S., also trying to drag other countries in. What's happening? Why is Saudi Arabia now so desperately attacking Yemen and so viciously from the air, of course? Why are they doing that? And then there's the Iranians. And then what's in it for Israel and the U.S.? Why don't we start with just the Saudis and maybe in Lebanon, their effort to, in fact, project their power over the entire area and wipe out any opposition to the kleptocratic royal family, in particular the new king.
Well, it's the new crown prince who's sort of taking over as his aging father gets ready to depart the scene. But Saudi Arabia is attempting to create a big regional coalition to smash the growing power, the growing regional influence of Iran. That is really what their grotesque and almost genocidal assault on Yemen is all about. They also virtually kidnapped and tried to force the resignation of the Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, Saad Hariri, who was actually a Saudi ally and almost protege, but the Saudis turned against him when he realized that bringing any kind of political stability to Lebanon required making some accommodating deals with Hezbollah and pro-Iranian forces there. So Yemen and Lebanon and other places risk being drawn into the vortex of really a set of Saudi-Iranian proxy wars, and that is part of also what's occurring in parts of Syria. It's difficult to summarize. It's difficult to summarize concisely, but overall, that's what's going on. Meanwhile, for those of us who are concerned about Palestine, we need to realize that what the Trump administration, through Jared Kushner, the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and the Israeli government of Netanyahu have cooked up an utterly horrible and unsustainable plan to impose a Bantustan solution on the Palestinian-occupied territories, something that no Palestinian leadership could possibly accept, but they think they can do it through raw power. As for the Israeli angle, if I could say just briefly, there are two things. They believe that this kind of scheme could crush Palestinian resistance entirely. And secondly, for Israel, the occupied territories are sort of a laboratory and proving ground for their techniques of repression and their highly sophisticated weaponry, which they can test out on populations and opposition movements and then market to repressive regimes all around the world.
Yeah, their surveillance schemes are particularly effective and odious and murderous.
Yes. I don't want to demonize any country, and I don't want to glorify any of these regimes, Iran or any of the others. All of them are viciously repressive. None of them are progressive, but this is the overall climate. And American policy is making bad situations even more terrible.
This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Dave Finkel, who's an editor and editorial writer, who writes in other places as well, on the Middle East and Israel and the United States, on Palestine. Dave, we've gone over the horrific situation all over the Middle East, genocides in some countries, smaller lethal wars in others, and a growing push for regional war from the Saudis. Let's conclude talking about the U.S. and the Middle East. What game are they playing? It seems to me we could be looking at a repeat of the Iraq War, that is the Cheney-Rumsfeld-Bush adventure to change the Middle East, that all pushed by the Israelis. And we could see now a huge regional, a terrible regional war with Iran and Hezbollah as the an attack on them, and then other attacks all over. What's the thinking now in the United States policy circles? And could they put another Iraq war on? Could they again intervene in the Middle East in the same way?
Not in the same way, because they're not going to commit hundreds of thousands of ground troops overtly. There are larger numbers than have been admitted of American forces on the ground in Afghanistan, which is an absolutely unwinnable war. The U.S. has now been there for, what, if I'm not mistaken, 16 or 17 years. And the policies that President Obama and now Donald Trump have put in motion basically ensures that we'll be there for another 16 or 17 with no positive result. They believe that, at least the Trump administration believes that military power and threats can crush Palestinian resistance, can decisively defeat Iran, and somehow come to terms, this is another whole crisis that we don't even have to have time to talk about, with Turkey. None of these things will work, but the tactic is to rely on military power and threats. I'm not sure that there is a coherent overarching strategy at this point, because the situation, let's put it this way, the political situations there would be challenging to the most sophisticated, competent, and highly effective State Department leadership. That's number one. And number two, that's not the leadership that the State Department has at this point. A lot of it is hollowed out. So I'm not sure there is a coherent strategy, but the overall policies are enormously, enormously destructive.
And the Israelis, of course, they believe that, in fact, in the in a regional war, and all of the terrible news and the threats and the attention of the world on those wars, they'll be able to ethnically cleanse the occupied territories and set up the Bantustans. It seems to me that's part of their thinking.
That's a contingency plan. Let me say quickly that the catastrophes that have happened in Syria and Yemen and other places have sort of blotted out the enormous catastrophe taking place in Gaza, which is becoming uninhabitable. And I really recommend that people who are interested get Norman Finkelstein's new book from the University of California called Gaza, An Inquiry into Its Martyrdom. Very thorough and quite terrifying. And we don't hear much about it because so many larger scale terrible things have been happening. I want to say that as a movement, as an anti-war and peace movement in this country, we need to be urgently demanding the end of U.S. military supplies to Saudi Arabia. Code Pink has been very much in the forefront of this struggle, and we should all be behind that. And we should be behind the BDS boycott, divestment, sanctions movement to force Israel to end the occupation and respect Palestinian rights. It's the best organizing tool that we have, not that it can bring about a solution by itself, but it's the best organizing tool that we have to try and ameliorate the worst of the situation and bring pressure to bear on the Israeli occupation.
I suppose in the long run also, with climate change affecting so terribly the Middle Eastern countries, they could become uninhabitable in not too long a time, within the next 15 or 20 years. It seems to me that it's necessary for all humankind, and particularly for the people in the Middle East who are already suffering terribly, that we do something about greenhouse gas concentrations before they become irreversible and doom all of us.
Absolutely. We need an integrated understanding of the global crisis that we all confront.
That was a good way to end, Dave. Thank you very much. Good talking to you.
Okay, thank you.
Right. So long.
Country, a hard rain falls on the sea. If terror comes without a warning, there must be something we don't see. Well, fire begets this fire, like torches thrown into a straw. If no one asks and no one answers, that's how every empire falls.
And that's John Prine singing a song by J.B. Morris called That's How Every Empire Falls. If terror comes without a warning, there must be something we don't see. What fire begets this fire, like torches thrown into the straw? If no one asks, then no one answers. That's how every empire falls. And isn't that the way it is with the kinds of problems we address on the Old Mole? Poverty, racism, militarism? There must be something we don't see. If no one asks, then no one answers. Our job as moles is to ask those questions that lead us to the things we don't see and yet are the real reasons for the fires going on around the world, like how colonialism and neoliberalism led to 9/11 and to the ongoing wars in the Middle East we just heard Bill Resnick and Dave Finkel discussing. We'll link to Dave's article, Open and Hidden Horrors, when today's show is posted on the KABU website. And now here's a mole action alert. As you'll already know if you heard More Talk Radio in the last hour, poor people, clergy, and activists are holding a news conference today at 10 at the state capitol in Salem to serve notice on state legislative leaders that their failures to address the enmeshed evils of systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, ecological devastation, and America's distorted national morality will be met this spring with 6 weeks of direct action, including one of the largest waves of nonviolent civil disobedience in U.S. history. So we will link to more information and contact information about that on the webpage for today's show. Well, we all know that abortion providers and often women who seek them out are targets of insults and violence. Psychologist Jane Hassinger works with a project called Providers Share, helping groups of abortion providers to confront stigma. Now here's the Old Mole's Jan Hocken to talk with her.
Welcome to KABU, Jane Hassinger.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, you and your team at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor have been carrying out research on abortion stigma for many years now, research based on the experiences of providers in countries around the world. And as many of us know, since Trump's inauguration, this work has gotten harder, and that in addition to local laws restricting access to abortion in many places, providers face an increasingly harsh set of policies from the U.S. side. So before we talk about your work, could you just say a bit about what the gag rule is and how it affects women and healthcare workers around family planning services around the world?
Sure. Well, as you know, the gag rule, or what has been known as the Mexican rule, goes back to the administration of Ronald Reagan. It's waxed and waned in terms of its implementation, depending on whether or not we have a Democrat or Republican in office. But the gag rule impacts U.S. funding or USAID funding to reproductive and healthcare services around the world by means of withholding funds from any service that offers or promotes abortion, even including those services that also offer a full spectrum of health care for community members. So, you know, that could include family planning services, childhood vaccinations, HIV/AIDS testing and care, malaria, Ebola, and other infectious diseases. The policy has drastic impacts, therefore, on the health care of communities throughout the world. And because it's kind of poorly spelled out, it's sketched out in very broad terms, it tends to be that people are afraid of the loss of financial support, and so do tend to interpret it broadly, and if there's any chance at all that they might be perceived as promoting abortion, they don't talk about it. The fear of talking about abortion among recipients of USAID ultimately puts women at risk, women and their children and their families.
And that's a very important part of the research you do on abortion stigma. It both involves the policy material conditions that affect access to abortion, but also how the psychological and interpersonal dynamics that are part of this as well. People who enact these policies do understand at a certain level that they're meant to scare people and to shrink the worlds and lives and reaches of women and other marginalized groups. Can you say a little bit about what provider share encompasses and your approach to abortion stigma?
Provider share was an intervention conceived over 10 years ago. We've been at this now for 10 years. Based on our observation that abortion providers don't talk about the work they do. And we know that women who seek abortions for years have been stigmatized, but very little was understood about how stigma works to influence the experiences of abortion providers. And so we have the notion that we'd like to learn more about that, but we'd also like to provide some support for providers, presuming that working really under the great pressure associated with abortion stigma would be tough, hard on people's mental health, hard on esprit de corps, really, in teams of providers. So we designed a workshop to both support providers, to create a space where providers could safely talk about the work they do with one another, and also as a research intervention, a way to collect data to learn a good deal more. We noticed that the stigma about abortion provision and about providers is so intense that very little research even had been done. There was a very scant literature on the experiences of abortion providers, which is striking given that they are a highly trained, dedicated workforce, and there was almost nothing out there. So we wanted to contribute to the research literature as well as provide support for providers. And we designed a workshop that, when we began, it was a six-session workshop facilitated by a trained group leader. And we learned a lot from that first pilot project 10 years ago.
Before you continue with some of your findings, the first, I think, question that comes to mind is how we think about stigma in a context where there are clear legal ramifications to talking about it and providing abortions. And of course, there is some latitude, and perhaps you could talk about the legal latitude for abortion and how creatively that's used in different places in the world, and how you would distinguish between the political aspects of not speaking about something and stigma that carries more of this kind of psychological, psychosocial loading?
Well, it's a complicated factor, as you're suggesting. In places where abortion is legal, for example, in the United States, abortion stigma remains very strong. In some countries like Ghana, where abortion is basically legal and accessible, the attitudes that people carry about abortion are still so highly stigmatized that people actually don't know that abortion is legal in their countries. As abortion becomes more and more stigmatized and more regulated in the United States, we've learned that there are parts of the United States where people also don't know that abortion is legal and accessible. So stigma does a lot to confuse people about what their rights are and where the legal services are.
And over-internalizing, you're saying, repression isn't only an externally imposed force, but something that is reproduced in this
reproduced
way.
Over and over and over again, absolutely. The campaigns of stigma that we've seen in the United States in the last 10 or so years have been extraordinary and extraordinarily successful at influencing policymakers, at influencing changes in laws, increased regulations that have made, in some parts of the country, abortion virtually inaccessible. I think the last time I checked, in as many as 85% of American counties, abortion is not accessible. Yes, right. So, stigma as a psychological and social political phenomenon has had profound effects.
Now, there are many groups around the world working with reproductive health organizations or staff that include some component of what's called values clarification in addressing mm-hmm. sometimes ambivalence or conflict, and often mm-hmm. the conflict that workers bring to whatever the legal situation is in determining if and when women can terminate a pregnancy. Can you say a bit about how your work is similar to or different from these values clarification mm-hmm. workshops?
Sure. You know, our first concern really was to provide a safe, roomy enough space so that women providers could think deeply into what their work means to them and to share stories, complex stories about the moral intricacies involved in providing abortion. And we knew that that would take time and space. It would take building trust among members. It would take the opportunities for really taking risks with one another. A values clarification approach is certainly useful in getting clearer on what an individual's beliefs are, but it's a very limited intervention. It focuses basically on, you know, do I believe in women's right to abortion or not? I think the provider share workshop goes much more deeply, as I said, into the complexities of the issue and at a group level and a political level. It takes time to stretch out and to really dig deeply into those issues. And we wanted to provide time. We also wanted to provide time and space for ambivalence, as you mentioned. There needs to be room for ambivalence around such profound issues. We've also observed that the political climate that we live in now regarding abortion has pulled the debates and the discussion into very polarized shape, in a real situation in which one is not offered the opportunity to think in complex terms, is not offered the opportunity to be ambivalent. And we wanted to correct that situation in the workshop.
There's also a theory of groups that guides this work, that these are not simply internal or intrapsychic conflicts, mm-hmm. but are carried by groups and addressed by groups. Can you say something about that in terms of other findings you might mention?
Well, you mean the team itself?
Well, there's both the group as a team, your own work, but you also mm-hmm. work with groups and a concept of group dynamics when you address and kind of open up space for people to draw on each other and to allow for ambivalence.
Yeah, we've chose a group strategy for a couple of reasons. One is that we see the group, let's say in a team of abortion providers, as serving as a kind of microcosm of larger social dynamics out in the world. And that if members of the group have time to think together and to explore their experiences and reactions together, some of those dynamics in the outer world will begin to emerge. And people can begin to situate themselves as citizens in relation to some of these difficult issues, social and moral issues, as they talk and work together. Their attention then goes not only to their experiences in their teams with one another, but to their experiences out in the world, where they might do something like influence policy or become advocates or activists in various ways. So there's a lot of attention focused on what we learn here together as a group has applications out in the world to other groups in which we're members and participants.
This seems to also be related to, and perhaps we could close by talking a bit about the politics of shame. The shame studies has kind of emerged and has a certain cachet now in the humanities particularly. And it seems to me that your work very much relates to group dynamics related to shame,
mm-hmm.
abortion shame.
Well, stigma relies heavily on shame. And one of the things we point out to participants in our workshops is that stigma needs to be mobilized at a group level and has a set of dynamics that involve manipulating feelings of guilt and shame. And it's often very helpful to people to be able to see that what they're experiencing, which they regard as a highly personal individual experience, has its roots actually in a social dynamic out in the world, and that shame is used to manipulate people. Recently, I heard a story on NPR about a program developed by a group of anti-abortion activists that focuses on identifying ambivalent abortion providers and inviting them to quit their jobs using the enticement of offering money to quit their jobs as providers. And one of the ways they do that is by magnifying and manipulating shame and guilt.
And offering this also kind of quasi-therapeutic experience or
offering
a come to Jesus.
Therapeutic experience. Yeah. Exactly. So shame and guilt are tactics used to intensify and spread stigma.
And so this is part of what you help people understand and interpret their experiences, as well as to overcome the isolation attached often or as a product of shame.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or stigma.
Overcome isolation, clarify what the work, you know, means, make room for ambivalence, all of those things. Now, a secondary effect of this, we learned, much to our great satisfaction, is that the workshop does seem to have a positive effect at the team level in terms of increasing esprit de corps, improving teamwork, and we hope we'll see over time an impact on things like attrition.
In
the workforce.
Yeah, and in closing, there's also a film that should be available that we jointly carried out called Kuepo that grew out of this work, and we'll let listeners know how they can see that and other reports from your ongoing projects that give us a sense of hope as well as to counter our own feelings of shame that we have this administration in office. We should be ashamed. But we'll continue to follow this important work and keep it up.
Thank you, Jan.
Okay, this is Jan Hawken talking this morning with Jane Hassinger, the University of Michigan Ann Arbor, about the Provider Share team and their work around abortion, with abortion stigma around the world. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I arrived and pressed G5, and there was Nikki looking some kind of sad with tears falling from her eyes. She sat me down and dug my frown and began to run it down. You remember my boyfriend Sid, that fly kid who I love? Well, our love was often a verb, and spontaneity has brought a third. But due to our youth and economic state, we wish to terminate. About this we don't feel great, but baby, that's how it is. But the feds have dissed me, they ignored and dismissed me. The pro-lifers harassed me outside the clinic and called me a murderer. Now that's hate. So needless to say, we're in a mental state of debate. Hey, beautiful bird, I said, digging her somber mood. The fascists are some heavy dudes. They don't really give a damn about life. They just don't want a woman to control her body or have the right to choose. But baby, that ain't nothing. They just want a male finger on the button. Because if you say war, they will send them to die by the score. Aborting mission should be your volition. But if Suda and Thomas have their way, you'll be standing in line unable to get welfare while they'll be out hunting and fishing. It has always been around. It will always have a niche. But they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebomb.
And that's Diggable Planets with Female Fetal. Following the conversation about supporting abortion providers with Jan Hocken and Jane Hassinger, here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. We will have a link to the film Cueto that they referred to on the webpage for today's show. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, another tool in the Old Mole's kit for spreading the word and supporting people trying to make the world work for everyone is music. Seattle singer-songwriter Jim Page is a people's musical messenger, and the Old Mole's Desiree Helligers was able to sit down with Page recently about how he gets his music into the world. Here's Desiree.
My guest this morning is Jim Page, the Seattle-based legendary singer-songwriter. Jim, thanks so much for being here in the studio and letting me interview you.
My pleasure to be here. I have to tell you, KBOO is one of my favorite radio stations of all of them that I've ever been to.
So you are down here for the 30th Annual Winter Folk Festival, which is a fundraiser for Sisters of the Road Cafe.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're going to be airing the interview after the event, but it's a fabulous lineup, and so we're really hoping that folks will mark their calendar for next year. Your songs have earned praise from the likes of Winona LaDuke, Bonnie Raitt, Utah Phillips, Christy Moore, the Irish singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. And you've had plenty of opportunities to really go after commercial success if that had been your main love and life, which it clearly hasn't been. And instead, you've had a life that's been lived pretty close to your roots as a street musician, as a busker.
Well, I don't know how to say this, close to my roots. I don't know. There's a reality that happens between the song, the person doing the song, and the person listening to the song. And you can get distracted by taking those elements out of the immediacy where they are real, you know. And there's all kinds of ways to sing. You can sing in concert halls and clubs, and you can make records and all that stuff. And I've done all those things, and I do all those things again. But I don't play on the street a lot, but when I do, I think of it as like my laboratory. There's songs that I've written that the idea, not only the idea, but the attitude of them occurred to me while I was on the street. Because it's like, okay, here I am, and there's that person over there. How am I going to say something that makes sense to that person's immediate condition right now? And a word or a phrase pops into my head. Now, if I hadn't been there, that wouldn't have happened. I mean, maybe it would have, a roundabout and slowly or something, but in my experience, it's very valuable. It's really valuable. There's a few places that I still do it. I tend to sit down these days. When I used to be that I would stand up all the time to do that, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk some about your impact on the Northwest street musician scene, because it's really been profound, and I don't think all our listeners are aware of it. But I just want to say, first of all, that your songs engage a really broad range of really urgent social issues. Homelessness, mm-hmm. poverty, gentrification, which is obviously a huge issue in Seattle and Portland both. Militarism and wars from World War II to Vietnam, Central America, to the Middle East. You've written songs about extraction, deforestation, racism, police violence. I mean, I don't know if there's a really pressing social issue that you haven't engaged through music.
Well, the music does that. I mean, there's a lot of people doing that. I don't know. I hear people say, whatever happened to, you know, they say protest music. We all know what that means, okay? It's a silly word, but we know what it means. And people say, whatever happened to protest music? It's all over the place. Beyonce does it. It's all over the place. I mean, everybody does it. It's not hidden. It's not something that nobody's doing. It's just that when you use those words, everybody thinks of one person with a guitar. Well, that's a formula. That's a genre, let's say. It's not a content. There's two kinds of songs, basically. One is a song that addresses the human condition, the social condition. And then there's the song that, you know, is written for the marketplace. They're not the same. Sometimes they cross over, but, you know, if we're talking intents and purposes, they're not the same song. So my love has always been for the song that resonates, that makes a person feel right, that elevates myself, elevates them, elevates the situation. That's what's always felt right to me. That's what I'm attracted to. My first exposure to what a song could do was Lightnin' Hopkins, who was a great Texas blues singer. Lightnin', I don't think, ever learned to read or write. I don't think so. I don't know about that, but I don't think so. He spent time in the chain gangs. He came from a very tiny town that's about as big as this room in Texas called Centerville. But if you watch him, there's some YouTubes out there that you can go and you can watch this guy do what he did. He was a communicator in the classic sense. He would take his little town, his upbringing, his personhood, and show it to you in a way that made it okay for you to see. You know, it was brilliant. It was really brilliant what he did. It was amazing what one person with a guitar could do. There's a really good one where he's, you know, he's a black man from Centerville, Texas, a small town, and this little video he's singing to, I think it's like three white kids. They're like 10 years old or something like that, or eight, something like that. And he's got his harmonica player with him, you know, and he's playing, and he's talking about, he's telling the story about a little boy who had a stutter, uncontrollable stutter, but he discovered that if he sang, it went away, okay? And he was homeless, and he got taken in by this guy named Mr. Charlie, who owned a rolling mill. And Mr. Charlie says, you can stay in that shack right out there, okay? As long as you want. As long as I'm alive, you got a home. The only thing I want is if anything happens to my rolling mill, if it catches on fire, you run and tell me, okay? So sure enough, the rolling mill catches on fire, and the little boy runs, but he can't tell Mr. Charlie that the mill's on fire because he's stuttering so bad. So Charlie says, don't talk, sing. And then the song comes out. And you see these kids watching him, and it's like, oh, my God, they're entranced by what this guy does. That's what you can do with a song. You can cross generations. You can cross cultures. You can cross geography. You can cross class. You can cross all those divides with a song. That's why they're so great. And since I'm only one person and I can't do everything, I find the thing that works for me, and that's what I do. And a song for me, I don't know how to explain it. There's no way to explain it. It's just a good song. I mean, there's good love songs. There's good comedy songs. It's a good one. I don't know how to explain it. But it doesn't stop there. It's like it's the whole sphere of our human experience, right? Which includes homelessness, which includes police shootings, which includes the environment, which includes the guy in the White House, all that kind of stuff. All those things, we have the right to sing about them, and as an artist, I will go ahead and stick my neck out and say we have the obligation to sing about them. That's what I say.
So I kind of want to double back a little bit to 1974, right, which was the year that you were singing on a Seattle right. street corner, and you got approached by the cops, and yeah. that kind of became a moment that was pivotal for the Seattle music scene.
Say that word again, pivotal?
Pivotal.
Oh, I like pivotal better. It was out in front of Oliver's Meats, which is a butcher shop on Lower Pike Street between 1st and 2nd. And the motorcycle cop came up and he asked me for my permit, and I said, I don't have one. I just straightened right up, and I told him proudly, I don't have one. And he said, then I'll arrest you the next time I see you. And I said, well, I'll go get one. He says, you can't because you're not blind, and drove off. And I thought, what in the hell? So I packed up my guitar real fast, and I ran. I didn't walk. I ran down to City Hall, which is about 6 blocks away, something like that. And I went inside and I started asking questions. I don't remember who I asked, but I found out that, yes, it is illegal to sing on the streets of Seattle. It was illegal without a permit. And the only permits available were for so-called blind and disabled people. So it was catch 22. You had to have one, but I couldn't get one. You know, so it was weird. So, you know, to begin with, I was like, I was crestfallen to begin with. And then I thought, no, this is going to be, this would be a project. Let's see if I can do something with this. Because another thing is that songs, if you do a little busking, okay, remember, just because you play on the street doesn't mean you have to stay there. Just because you play in the concert hall doesn't mean you have to stay there. Okay, you don't have to stay anywhere. And that was what I did. That was how much fun I had. You could play in the city council chambers. I played in the city council chambers. I played in the bus stations. I walked into the TV station one day and said, I got a song that you should put on the news. And they said, well, go play it for so-and-so. And I went and played it for so-and-so, and he put me on the news. You go anywhere, okay? So I thought, well, this would be kind of fun to see if I can bring my songs and what I do into city government. And let's see if we can change. So, you know, I had a guy that sponsored me. I had friends in the media already. I went and talked to them. Seattle PI just went and found somebody. He was interested. His name is Rick Anderson. He's still a writer, but he's, you know, freelance. Dean Patton wrote for the University of Washington daily. I had friends in the TV stations, radio stations. We set up a city council meeting. And then I made up little flyers that said, Jim Page, City Council Chambers, 2:30 in the afternoon, Wednesday. You know, and I put them around town, all the places I played. I was playing on the university campus in those days, drawing pretty good-sized crowds, so I put them around there. So I treated it like a gig, you know, and the council chambers filled up, which is not an easy thing to do at 2:30 in the afternoon on a Wednesday. But they did. They filled up with all these, you know, weird-looking people with weird hair and clothes and stuff to come down there. And it was a trip, and it was really easy. It was really easy. They passed it. I don't think it would be that easy nowadays, but I could be wrong.
And you sang your testimony.
Yeah, I wrote a song for it called Now's the Time for Talking, because it was 1974 and that was Watergate. And Watergate was happening because people were lying and they were breaking into each other's offices and so on and so on. And my theory was, and it's not a theory, it's true actually, is that what you don't need less talk, you need more. We need to go out and talk in public. And busking is like being the town crier in a way. You go out, you sing in public. Singing is like talking. Talking is like crying. Busking is like being the town crier. You go out and you sing in public. And if you don't have a song written for what just happened this morning, you make it up. You make it up. You use three chords, 1, 4, 5, just like a blues played in the key of C. And you sing it or you talk it, but you do it right now. You don't have to write these things down. And you just go do that. And that's what I did. I did it for like 6 years or something. 7 years, 8 years in Seattle, you know.
And it was another 20 years before busking was decriminalized in Portland.
Oh.
So that Seattle move, you know, had a huge impact ultimately on Portland, but it took a while for that impact, I think, to hit.
Well, they're all different. The situations are all different. Every city has a different history, different set of laws, you know. And, you know, and then you have a different population. You got to get people engaged and interested and go do it. And once you do it, it's like you take over the streets. You know, whose streets? Our streets. You go sing on those streets that are our streets, you know, and there's your public voice. I mean, you had to write this book and you had to find a publisher. I could write a song and go out and play it right now. Right now.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I didn't have to write it. I could just go out and sing right now. Could do that. And that was the beauty, is the beauty of the immediacy of what it is. You know, there's any. You can go out there and do anything. You can do country western covers. You can do Rolling Stones songs. Doesn't matter. Whatever you want. But you can also do your own experience. You can also jump in there and be a town crier. And it's scary, but it's very rewarding. It's very fun and very rewarding. Rewarding. Rewording. I'm rewording the rewarding so it comes out right.
Yeah, so I know also that you've spent a lot of time in and around Seattle's houseless community,
yeah.
That you've spent a lot of time in the tent cities, that you've written about houselessness and gentrification and poverty. It seems like those songs really come out of a pretty intimate witness for the kind of struggles that people are undergoing.
Yeah, well, I've been a renter for a long time. And being a renter, especially at my income level, is always like 1 week away from, 1 month away from being homeless. I was homeless years ago in New York City. It was in the summertime and I was young, so it was gnarly, but it was not terminal or anything like that. So I have a little bit of personal experience. But other than that, I know that my job is not only to write songs and to sing them, but to go find them. And to find them, you go where those songs are, where they live, which is in the people. So you walk around town, ride your bicycle, take the car, whatever, and you see tents in every open, vacant lot and people living in doorways. Like, what is this? You know, what's going on? Go find out. Go find out. Go down to the offices of the local homeless paper. Go talk to somebody selling the homeless news. Go. Don't just go walk into a tent city like you own the place because that's their home. But, you know, there are ways to do it. Should I play a song?
Yeah, absolutely.
I went to Nicholsville.
Which is one of Seattle's 10 cities.
Yeah. Nicholsville started in... let me think now. I think 2008. It was on disused land belonging to the county. Because that way the city couldn't shut them down, right? At least that was the theory. Friends of mine, Anita Freeman, Joe Martin, Tim Harris, they were all involved in it. Anitra was really involved in it. And they had all these pink tents. They were donated by the Girl Scouts. There you go. And they set up all the tents and they built wooden sidewalks. And they called themselves Nicholsville after the mayor, Greg Nichols, of the time. The idea was that he was responsible, or at least he was overseeing, while the economic crash happened that displaced all those people. And I think it was Anitra's idea that this would give him the opportunity, since it was named after him, to be the first mayor in the country to welcome organized homeless people. Well, it existed there for a while, and then it got evicted. Me and Joe went out there and sang for a while people took their tents down and stuff. It sounds kind of awkward, but people liked it and they enjoyed it. Then it had to move around, and during the winter, 2009 maybe, it was in the back of a church at the University District. It was really cold. Everything was frozen. I went there to just meet people and say hello, and I wrote this song. Too cold for rainbows, too cold for sun, too cold for downpours. We gonna get one. You better run for cover. Rally around that flag. Ain't got a raincoat. I got a plastic bag. Come sit down by the fire. It'll do some good. Gonna keep it going long as we got firewood. Too cold to sit down. Too cold to stand. Too cold to say hello, but I can shake your hand. This is where we live now, so come on in. Long as you ain't looking for trouble, you're welcome, friend. Pull a sleeping bag over. Batten it down. Try to keep it level so we don't roll out on the ground. Living in America. Tin City, living in America, in Tin City, living in America, in Tin City, living in America, in Tin City, and it's just trickling down. To be living in tents, too cold to camp. Try to stay dry, everything gets damp. Too cold to be living outdoors. Yeah, but you can tell that to the cops. Ain't got no other place to go, and the weather won't stop. Take a letter to the mayor, deliver it for me. Tell her we'd all like to see her down here, keeping good company. Too cold, but what you gonna do? Gotta live somewhere, and you know it's true. I can't pay the mortgage, I can't afford the rent. After food and bus fare, my money's just about all spent. Take a message to the man. Whisper it in his ear. Tell him until we see some changes, we're gonna stay right here. Living in America, the intense city in Sacramento. Living in America, the intense city in Dignity Village. Living in America, the intense city in Nicholsville. Living in America, the intense city all over the place.
Been listening to the first in a two-part interview with legendary Northwest singer-songwriter Jim Page. Special thanks to Mike Buckman for his help with this segment. You can show your support for Portland's houseless community by calling the mayor's office and telling them to stop the sweeps and recognize and support the city's newest tent city, Village of Hope in Northeast Portland. The number for the mayor's office is 503-823-4120. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mill Variety Hour.
And that call to action by Desiree Helliger is to call the mayor's office at 503-823-4120 to end the sweeps of unhoused people and recognize the Village of Hope. Concludes today's Old Moles Variety Hour. Many thanks to Desiree and Jim Page for their interview about music and politics, to Jane Hassinger and Jan Hocken for their discussion of the need to support abortion providers in their difficult work, and to Dave Finkel and Bill Resnick for their analysis of wars in the Middle East. I'm Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Patsy Kullberg, reminding you to tune in again at 9 next Monday morning for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Moles Underground perspective. And check out our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. For links to the audio for today's show and past shows, as well as additional information about topics and guests. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.